Hello and welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series which focuses on the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico, from where it has come and to where it's going. In this program, we will look at the current state of land and water use and development in New Mexico. We will listen to voices of farmers, ranchers, and scholars from all around the state.
Well, I would say that it's happening all over the country. It's not just happening in the western United States.
That was Peter Vigil, director of the Soil and Water Conservancy District in Taos, New Mexico. Development is hard to control or oversee for any agency in New Mexico or around the country.
We've looked into the situation and we've found that in the United States in general, we're in a time where it's unprecedented for growth. What that means is that in no time in our nation's history has there been more subdivisions and homes being built and things of that nature. The district could probably list that as probably a top conservation priority is just the sprawl from the urban areas into traditional non-developed areas. And we see that result in northern New Mexico. We see that a lot of development is taking place. Our job as a conservation district is to minimize the impact of that development.
And development is a big concern over the entire western United States. If you look at growth projections, most of the western states are projected to grow immensely in the next few years. New Mexico in the next 40 years, we're expected to grow by 85%. States like Utah in that same 40-year period of time are expected to double a lot of the western states. And where's the water going to come from?
John D'Antonio is the state engineer for New Mexico. His office determines where water goes in the state.
Well, essentially in most of those states, roughly 75% of water is being used in agriculture. When we consider most of our river basins and stream systems fully appropriated, it means we're not going to allow for a new use to come in and use new water. There's got to be a change in place and purpose of use of existing water. So naturally, as populations grow, there's going to be some water that's going to have to come out of agricultural production to accommodate the growth of our cities. To really have a sustainable economy and a state, my feeling is that you've got to have a strike of balance between those. You can't allow too much water to go out of agriculture because you need those green belts to be able to maintain, and you need to be able to manage yourself through the cycle of droughts that we're going to continue to have, and you certainly don't want all water coming out of agriculture.
New Mexico's water is being adjudicated. In other words, the state has to decide who has water rights and whose rights have priority, or who's had their rights longer. However, many farmers and ranchers are skeptical of the adjudication process, which is complicated as there is four times as much water allocated as actually exists in the state due to previous state engineers' water deals. Also, the transfer of water from agriculture to development worries people, as some argue that the majority of the agriculture is in the eastern part of the state, while much of the growth comes from the middle Rio Grande Valley, including Albuquerque and Rio Rancho.
Well, I think the state engineer is under pressure to be able to provide water both to commercial and residential development. And so I believe at least that he feels that he is under pressure to make sure that those water resources are available to those two groups. And he feels that he needs to take water from agriculture to give it to them.
Dino Cervantes, chili grow in La Mesa, New Mexico, in the southern part of the state.
I think agriculture stance would be that we have a right to ownership, the amount of water that we have traditionally used, historical values, if you will, and that's the water that we actually have. As far as supplying residential commercial areas, we feel like the free market system, for the most part, once that ownership is granted, will take care of itself. If the city needs water, it'll go to Farmer A and buy water from Farmer A. If Farmer A needs water for his crop, he can go buy water from Farmer B, and so on down the line, rather than create a bureaucracy of trying to say, you don't need it, you do need it, you deserve it, you don't deserve it. I think that that's going to be problematic going forward. Really, the only way to do it is to allow historical users to get or grant them what they have rightful ownership to, and then let market conditions kind of take it from there.
The acequias are their own entity. They're their own governing body existing before U.S. laws ever came into the territory. Working between pueblos and indio-hispano communities, the acequias have problems as well. They need more money to continue. They need more and more maintenance as time goes by. This is difficult as people have to work 9-to-5 jobs as well as farm. Again, Peter Vika.
Well, I don't think it's in good shape. Okay. I try to put a positive tint on it, but a long time ago when people farmed for their sustenance and they didn't have jobs in town, any little repair that was needed on that system was done right away. It was nipped in the bud. Mm-hmm. And now that we are farmers, when we get off of work at 5 o'clock, those little problems, get bigger and more severe. So the overall health of the system, you could question that because we don't have the time or the money to fix it. But the system needs to be used and fixed because it is what connects us back to where we came from. Man and women are of the earth. And you can't lose that connection. And the acequia and trees and riparian areas are things that remind us subconsciously of that connection. That's why, hopefully, they've been very generous to us in the past couple of years. This was a great legislative session in New Mexico for water. So we look positively at that. But I mean, the battle isn't over. I mean, it's been a 500-year battle, and maybe it'll go on in the future. And there's always, a new problem on the horizon. But at least, people listening, they might become encouraged to become proactive and active and progressive in these types of activities and associations.
Development has grown all over the state, but some areas have grown in a way that makes it more difficult for families that have been in these areas for generations. I asked Luis Hina of Tezuque Pueblo what changes his community has seen from development.
There's hundreds of homes, each one with a straw going into the aquifer, each one drawing its amount of water. And so it's impacting us in those terms. And then when they build these homes, they're destroying centuries-old land management structures on the ground. And so when they destroy these structures by building roads and putting in their homes on these mesas or on these slopes, there's no more recharge. There's more hit cutting, which forms the arroyos. All that sediment comes down and impacts the river riparian habitat, which kills off your fish population. With these homes, you're looking at the devegetation or deforestation of the area, and also the importation of exotics. And just by coming down the Rio Grande, you're seeing all the real tamarisks and the Russian olives and how it's impacting the riparian systems. And just like with GE contamination, it's going to spread. Now they're talking about letting GE evergreen trees to pollinate and see how they react. But there's already studies found that grass, alfalfa pollens are escaping. Hopefully, people will find out about it and oppose the studies. With all this development, there's less vegetation, which means no biodiversity. Probably you're looking at the reserve as just being the only green zone probably within 20 years, an open space. So that's kind of how it's impacting us here. Also irrigation. I have people upstream from me. However, we have a good working relationship so that in case, in the past where we've had no water, we've kind of declared our priority to use the water.
Taos and other communities where tourism is the main industry face problems with people building their second homes, creating real estate bubbles where the price of land is based on beauty, desire, and relaxation rather than what the land gives to the community. Ernie Atencio from the Taos Land Trust, an organization which helps people permanently protect their land from development.
Well, it definitely has had an impact, and it's part of what we are facing every day in terms of trying to do our land conservation work, because property values are just skyrocketing. Taos is in one of those weird real estate bubbles, and values continue to climb at pretty high rates, and they don't seem to be slowing down a lot. Some realtors might be complaining about it, but as far as I can tell, it's still increasing. So as property values increase, a lot of the local community people who might be rich in land but cash poor, they may not have a lot of other opportunities. They don't have options in terms of making money. They don't have access to other capital. They don't have other investments. They've got their land. So when it comes time to send the kids to college or other financial needs, the only asset they have to fall back on is the land. And it must be very tempting. So I don't fault people for choosing to sell their land, but it's that land that's being developed. But I would say probably the biggest threat is development. This incredibly growing population, a very wealthy population in this country, and people are looking for places for their retirement homes, their second or third homes. Ranchers and farmers are having a tough time making a living. It's never been an easy livelihood, but economic forces these days are making it even more difficult, especially if you're a small-scale, family-scale farmer, rancher. Here comes somebody with a wad of cash looking for a place to build a house, and it's a tremendous temptation for people to sell out. And I think more or less the same is true on these vast swaths of ranch land around the West as they are on these small pieces of irrigated farmland here in Taos County. And the pace of development is outpacing conservation across the country. If I remember the figure right, I think each year about 2 million acres go under to development throughout the U.S., and we're permanently protecting only about 750,000 acres. So if you want to look at it as a race, maybe this will be a happy ending tortoise and hare kind of a story, but at this point, conservation is losing and development is winning. And whatever you think about farming, ranching, these traditional rural livelihoods, traditional rural cultures in northern New Mexico, or ranch communities across the West, whatever you think about it, the whole cows versus condos argument, we're losing the land. And if we don't figure out some way to come together over this, set aside political agendas, like I like to say, leave your guns and your politics at the door and let's get to work on the real issues that we all care about. So if we don't figure out a way to do that, we're just going to lose it all.
You're listening to The Shift of Land, where we look at the connection between land and culture in New Mexico. Roger Bowe, a cow-calf rancher from near San Juan on the eastern side of the state, explains what a traditional ranching community is like in an area where there aren't jobs, where land is becoming more and more expensive, and it's harder and harder to live as a farmer or rancher.
Our community has become one of middle class to a lot lower class, because there's not that many jobs. And the jobs are real, you know, service-oriented around, you know, service stations or motels or whatever. There's really not any businesses here to give good jobs right now. And poor ranchers, he can't pay very much either. So there's really no incentive for a lot of people to come in here at this time. But who knows how it'll change.
I asked Mr. Bo what trends he saw coming in.
Well, right now, the big issue right now is corn prices. The corn prices have nearly doubled, and this is due to the, you know, probably the ethanol boom, which is based on something that's, well, it probably takes more energy to produce a gallon of ethanol than what you get out of it. And it's mainly a political thing, as far as I'm concerned. I just don't believe you put food in your gas tank. That's what you're doing. And I don't think it's sustainable at all. I don't know the answer to the so-called energy crisis, but that's not it. I'm a firm believer in that. And what this is doing, and if it continues, if corn prices stay so high, then it's going to take longer and longer to get our beef to the table. And which probably isn't a bad thing, because it's going to, really, we should spend, the cattle should spend more and more time on grass instead of in the feed yard. But as long as corn is cheap, it's, you know, they can gain so much faster on it and everything. You know, corn's a grass. It's like feeding them grass, but it's more concentrated. It's higher energy and everything. And you can grow them out faster. But I'm looking at probably if corn stays so high, we'll probably keep our calves longer and longer on grass, yeah, or wheat pasture or whatever, which, I, you know, that's not a bad thing. But it's going to make beef more expensive, which will, you know, if our economy stays good in the U.S., people, you know, it doesn't take much out of their income as far as food does. But if it starts crashing or something, then it'll reduce our demand considerably.
People around the world are being affected by the idea of growing corn for ethanol production. Food prices are going up. In Mexico in December 2006, tortillas, which normally cost between 4 and 6 pesos per kilo, went up to 10 to 15 pesos due to the price of corn. This, where in Mexico City, the minimum wage is 35 pesos per day. A family of four will go through 1 to 2 kilos at one meal. A New York Times report in September of 2007 quoted a report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development that replacing 10% of America's motor fuel with biofuels would require about a third of the total cropland already dedicated to cereals, oils, and sugar crops. The production of this alternative fuel is also dependent on petroleum. In the interviews that I've done around the state, a few ranchers in the eastern area had mentioned concerns with the dairy industry, which happens to be the largest industry in New Mexico right now. New Mexico dairies are the seventh largest producer of milk, eighth in cheese production in the nation. They produce 38 million pounds of milk per year with an estimated profit of $5.8 million. The concerns that people brought up were that these dairymen came to New Mexico because the land and water was cheap. They worried that once the water from the Ogallala, which is almost dry, was gone, that the dairies would move to other places where their profits would be just as high. I asked Roger Bowe what he thought as a neighbor to the area.
That concerns me. The Ogallala has been a concern of everybody around here for a long time. I remember back when I was in college, I did a research study on what would happen to the irrigated acres if, you know, natural gas prices went way up, if there started reduction in the water table and whatever. It becomes more and more expensive to get it out. And that's what's happened, is it really didn't pay to irrigate wheat or corn at those prices for a long time. But it does pay to irrigate to feed the dairy cows. And so it's just a natural thing. But as time goes on, it becomes more and more expensive to get that water out. Then they'll have to either truck their feed in or move somewhere else. But again, the dairy situation, I think, is related to more to suburban creep than mine, because, you know, most of them come from California. They can sell their land for who knows what, and they come down here with pockets full of money. I mean, they build these houses that are unbelievable. So, you know, they got a pocket full of money from selling their land there. And this land is relatively cheap. I mean, really cheap to them compared to there. And so the cost of production has gone down quite a bit. So that's, you know, it's just a natural thing. You move to where you have the best competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. How can you afford to have dairy cows on a place that's worth $10,000-$12,000 an acre when you can get it here for $1,000? You know, they're just being smart. You know, I can't blame them for doing it. And this brought a lot of jobs to around the Clovis area, and it hasn't necessarily been a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Like I say, the water's the big thing here. Mm-hmm. We'll just see how far it goes. I don't know. Supposedly, Ogallala recharges a little bit. I don't know how fast. Yeah. Nobody does.
Right.
it's shrunk in size, and you have to go deeper. They're looking at maybe running a pipeline from Ute Lake and all, but it's still, we're in the desert here. On the edge of the desert, anyway. I mean, we get around 16 inches of rain a year. In the last 4 or 5, we probably hadn't had that much in the last 4 or 5. Last year, about July, it started raining good. But before that, it was the last 4 or 5 years have been really dry. So it's been tough to. We've a lot of reduction in cattle in this area, and it's just now coming back. So we'll see how long that lasts.
Another concern that people brought up was the increase in ranchettes. 10 to 40 acre plots that are being sold off of larger ranches as second homes or homes but non-working ranches. Jason Tillman, rancher from the San Juan area, explains ranchettes.
I have a Cowboys and Indians is a magazine that we get here on the ranch. There's tons of ranchettes in there for sale. Okay, a ranchette would be, this happens a lot, okay? There's somebody with a 10,000 acre ranch, kids of, you know, it's a family place, you know, but they're having a hard time paying the bills, right? They're in this beautiful country with a river through it and mesas, and it's just unbelievably pretty, you know, like God's green earth kind of thing, because there's so much of ranches are like that, you know, there's so much beautiful country out there. Anyway, they find out that they can sell 35 acres of their ranch for basically what the whole ranch is worth. And not only can they do it once, they can do it about 20 times. And when they do this, they sell someone a 35-acre patch out of a 10,000-acre ranch and add it up. Say they sell 20 of them. That's 7,000 acres, okay? They have 3,000 acres, what they would call open space, which includes these people's home. The original owners, a lot of times, or the new owners, because investors will come in and buy it. But and the cattle pens, and that's a big deal when they sell. It's like a working ranch. Oh, you know, buy part of a working Western ranch. So these people still run cattle, you know, or they still run horses. But they make so much money off of selling all those lots that they're not even around. It doesn't matter. But anyway, what you do is you sell off your 35 acres or 10 acres, whatever, and you got to build the roads, infrastructure. Water's a problem. This is the West. Basically, most of these ranchettes, they make the owners drill their own wells. And these people are rich and they can afford it, right? Because you're coming out and you're paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for 35 acres. You know, up to $750,000 or more for 35 acres, you know, to be in this perfect spot. And you've got a gated community. I mean, the beginning of the ranch, there's a gate, right? And you go back in there and they make these houses where you can't see them, you know, like they're in the trees, they're in the mesas. So visually, at least from the highway, the only thing that gets messed up is like a huge entryway. And it says, The key term here is ranchettes, right? Okay, they'll call them ranchettes anyway. But there'll be a nice entry gate, depending on how rich the people like that are buying them are. But sometimes it's really low pro. You know, like it'll just be a nice ranch gate. Okay, where this ranch used to have 7 wells, it's going to have freaking 37 wells, right? So they're pulling that much more water from the ground. Then they're getting the electricity piped in there. Which they'll be rich enough to do underground electricity, but underground electricity, you still have to cut it through there, you know? And these people aren't there, right? And that's, you know, that's maybe why the ranchers in the beginning think, ah, it's going to be all right. But your land, like you tie up the rest of the land, say the 3,000 acres of open space, that's how you sell them. You're like, you buy 35 acres, but you get 3,000 acres of open space. Which it's all deeded to every single person. So you can ride horses or do whatever they do, right? But anyway, what this does is it drives up the taxes so much. Like the land all of a sudden that used to be worth 500 an acre is worth something ungodly like 5,000, 10,000 an acre because someone from California or New York or something will pay it, right? To have that Western. And that's happening everywhere. You know, like you can drive anywhere in Colorado and find them, you know, no problem. And that ruin, I mean, that right there is what runs the West. Those people come in, and what it does is the property taxes go up so high on the neighbors that are really trying to make a living off ranches that they have to do the same thing. And they see the money, you know, and they need to make, they need to eat. So I really, you know, these ranchettes are horrible. It's the end of the West as we know it. It's bringing suburbs right to my back porch.
I asked John DeAntonio, state engineer, the person in charge of where the water goes to in the state, what it means to be New Mexican.
Well, you know, I'm a new, native New Mexican. I was born in Albuquerque. I went to school here. I went to college in New Mexico. You know, it's my home state. I recognize, you know, the cultural diversity within the state of New Mexico. I understand and have to balance the Native American water rights issues with the Spanish and Mexican culture that has come across, and so a lot of the acequia development, the early irrigation districts that came with the federal projects, and now most recently the economic development interests that come in, and the jobs that are provided, and where our kids are going to maintain hopefully a place to work when they you know get of the age where they're going to be looking for jobs. And so, you know, as a native New Mexican, I really feel like it's my responsibility to balance all these uses, to make sure we have responsible economic growth. We take care of the environment, but we also provide for those opportunities to have a sound economy. And it's a real tricky situation. We've got a lot of issues that we're dealing with. Really, the climate variability is a big issue, and things that we're trying to get in place within the state involve a lot of measuring and metering devices that we need to put in place. We have accountability of water use. We're trying to put in rules and regulations so that we know how to manage water and the rightful person gets their water. And really, we need to try to maintain those agricultural communities so that if and when we get into those drought cycles, because we know those drought cycles are going to happen, that we have the ability to employ some water banking techniques and some things to allow water to transfer within a reasonable amount of time so that we can actually continue our economies but provide enough drinking water, really take into consideration the safety and health of our citizenry. So I think being a New Mexican in this position is very important.
How do we balance the history of New Mexico and still work with the changes and trends that come in with land use and development? This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rapid for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder, associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.